Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching from God's Word you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to Him. If you're ever in the Madison, Alabama area, we'd love for you to worship with us on Sundays at 8:30 or 10:30 a.m. If you have any other questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, find us at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to also check out our Bible study podcast, Madison Church of Christ Bible Studies. Thanks again for stopping by.
Man, I'm so excited today. I have a friend from high school that showed up here today. I bumped into him in the community, and Willie and his wife, Regina, are with us today. It makes me so happy. I can't even tell you I'm so excited. And I hear the songs and the tone that we're lifting up this morning, and I just, you know, as I think about that, the heaviness of the songs that we've been singing are on purpose. All that's intentional because we're looking at something that is a little bit maybe darker than what we are accustomed to having here at Madison. And the messaging this morning will be a little bit different than what you've been accustomed to, especially as we think about the way of Jesus. I was thinking about this week, that if the Lord gives us another day, tomorrow will be the 15th anniversary of the tornadoes that came through this area. And I know in the state of Alabama, there was lots of carnage that took place as a result of that. There were, I think it was 62 tornadoes that came through Alabama that day on April 27, 2011. And I think as they went through, there were 250 plus people who passed away because of the injuries they sustained in that tornado. And there were thousands of others who were in the hospital. Of course, we lost power. Of course, there were lots of things that took place. And a lot of us were downstairs in the Madison room, weathering the storm, getting through all of that. It was a long night with no power, no air conditioning. And as we were in that building, we kept hearing updates of things and people that we knew had been impacted. Tornadoes that had come through our area. I think it was 8 EF4 and maybe 3 EF5 tornadoes that came through our area alone. Shut things down for several days, and you guys remember, the morning after that storm, over the 18 hours that those tornadoes came and ravaged our area, Cindy and I got out in the car and we drove around with our children. We were looking at some of the things that took place. And this was before, like, they started closing down the roads and people were looting some homes and those kinds of things. And when you looked at these images, you know, these are just us driving down the road. There were some that I'm sure were more catastrophic than what we see here. But as we were driving along, I couldn't help but notice that at times we would see people standing in their yard, or what was their yard, looking at the devastation everywhere. And you could see the look of hopelessness in their eyes. I mean, where do we begin? Where are our photographs? Where are all those things that we held sacred, our family heirlooms? Where are all the things that made our house a home? Where were the things that are scattered everywhere now? How will we ever start over? What do we do? And not knowing where to begin. I want you to couple that kind of hurt and fear and sorrow and grief with what we experienced, if we get to September, 25 years ago on 9/11, when we were attacked and those Twin Towers came falling down. Thousands of people were killed. Lots of lives were changed. I think as we watched in horror on the news and we saw how this progressed and we saw the rubble and the dust everywhere, New York City became eerily silent. And I remember as you watched this being overcome with anger, sorrow, frustration, lots of questions, confusion about things. Why could this happen? How could this happen? And what are we going to do about it? And I remember that even though I wasn't a New Yorker, and probably none of you were New Yorkers at the time, we all became New Yorkers, right? We were pulling for them to pull together and to unite. And it was a beautiful time in our country, even though we went through that devastation and the horrors of it. Like, we all began to support each other again. We all began to love each other and to work hard for each other and to try to seek the best for one another. And things were so different then. But if you could capture the emotion of those moments and how you may have talked to God during those days. That sets up kind of the feeling that I have when it comes to this series we're calling When Walls Fall from the Book of Lamentations. Now, we just got through with a series that was so rich and challenged us to walk in the ways of Jesus. It was very kind of positive, but also kind of stomped on your toes a little bit. This one is a different book. In fact, I was reminded of this when I was thinking about it. My kids all got in band when they were in middle school. And Gage, of course, picked the tuba because he liked that really deep voice, you know, that deep note. But both Kenzie and Nick both chose the trombone. And do you know why they chose the trombone? Because they wanted to make the wah, 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 wah. They wanted to make that noise. That was it. That was the whole reason they got into band for trombone. Right? Well, that's kind of how I feel about this lesson. That's kind of how I came into this feeling about this series. As we were looking at this and studying, I'm thinking, oh man, this is such a dirge. And literally, that's what Lamentations is. It's a series of five funeral poems, so to speak, and it expresses lament. Okay, well, what is lament? I want you to understand, it's kind of like crisis language. It's like when you're feeling despair and sorrow and hurt and anger. It's like a place for you to express that fear and the pain that you're going through in hopes that you can articulate it enough to where God in heaven can hear those things and react and respond. It's a place for us to deal with our confusion, our frustrations, our hurts. And it's meant to be something that we do, that we are actually permitted to do. I think sometimes when we think about the anger that we may feel at times, it may hurt us to think that we would say something to God that would sound disrespectful or irreverent in some way. And yet, as I look at the scriptures, there's all kinds of examples of lamentation in the Bible that we can hold on to. Here's an example, Psalm 13. This is the Psalm of David. And we know David to be a man after God's own heart, right? We understand that he's a guy that God looked down to, had his problems, had his issues. He certainly wasn't perfect. But there was something about his heart that God looked down and said, okay, that's my kind of person, right? And here is David, and the background of this is he's fleeing Saul. Saul's trying to kill him. You know, David's been anointed the next king. Saul is trying to do his best to kill him, but David has been very, you know, loyal to Saul and done everything he could to serve in very powerful ways and great ways. But this keeps happening over and over that Saul is out to get him. And here are the words that David expresses. He says, how long, O Lord? How long will you not forget me? Will you forget me forever? He says, how long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? He's asking the question. He says, how long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Can you hear the frustration? Can you hear the sorrow mixed with angry, mixed with confusion and all of those emotions that we might have in those moments? But then here's another one. And this one will sound familiar. My God, why have you forsaken me? Can you hear the voice of Jesus saying that while on the cross? Why are you so far from saving me? From the words of my groaning, oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer. And by night, and I find no rest. Man after God's own heart, calling out to God in his desperation, filled with anger, frustration, curiosity, confusion, and everything else. And there he is, pouring himself out to God. What I want us to understand is that Lamentations is that book that helps us understand a situation that was going on with them in the land of Judah that we probably can't possibly identify with. But the background of this story happens in 2 Kings 24 and 25, 2 Chronicles 36, Jeremiah 39 through 40. You can read those sometime, but I'll try to gel it down as best I can. What we're going to be talking about is the third siege on Jerusalem, God's holy city. and it took place after two other attacks by Babylon. They came in, and the first time they came in and captured a bunch of people and kind of ransacked the city, but they left it in enough state that they could repair and rebuild. But in that first deportation, they took out people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those guys who came and they served in the Babylonian kingdom. But then the second time they came back, that one happened in 605 B.C. The next one was 597 B.C. And with this second deportation, they came in, attacked the city again. Despite all that happening, you know, Judah didn't change any of their behaviors. And so this next time, 586 B.C., is the third siege on the city. And this time, Babylon comes and completely destroys the city. They come in, they knock down their walls. They knock down all the houses. They steal all the treasures of the temple. All those special and precious emblems of precious metals that were used in the service within the temple, but also the things that were caught up in the storehouses, the treasures that were kept there. Then they turn and they burn the temple to the ground. And in the middle of all these things, they also grabbed all of the inhabitants, most of them, not every single one of them, but most of them, they were all taken off into captivity to Babylon, a 1,000-mile hike. It says that they were put yokes on their neck, and they would carry them away kind of like slaves. And these people were taken into exile to be with Babylon and to be their servants. So I look at this situation. King Zedekiah was the one who, when they came in, he fled. He and all of his royal family, they took off. And Babylon caught up after them, brought Zedekiah and his sons together, took his sons right in front of him and killed him. And then they poked his eyes out. Then they led him off to be in captivity as well. They killed the fields. They took away all their food. They did everything they could to completely leave this place in smoking rubble. And so what you have here as you look at this situation and the destruction of this city that God had promised them. Remember, he took them out of Egypt and said, I'm going to give you this land. And then this land was built into this great, colossal city, a great city. And it had been totally ravaged and taken down. So when I think about who writes this and who's the author of Lamentations, he's known as the weeping prophet. His name is Jeremiah. There's tradition that says that he actually, when the destruction was taking place, he escaped up into a mountain nearby. He was in a cave that is known now as Jeremiah's Grotto. As he went into that cave, it was near Golgotha, of all places. And he sat in that cave and he looked out and he watched what took place over Jerusalem. And he sat down to pen these things. But the interesting thing about this is these five poems that are there in the book of Lamentations all have kind of a rhythm to them a little bit. Each of the first two chapters have 22 verses. Each of those verses start with one letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and it goes all the way from Aleph all the way down to Tau, the 22 letters. So the first two chapters kind of have that rhythm. They have this certain pace, and each one of them is designed to mirror that alphabet. The thought is that in the construction of this, that the suffering that they went through, the struggle that they endured, was meant to be kind of a totality of suffering from A to Z, so to speak, in our terminology. But chapter 3 is three times that. Every letter has three of those sentences that start with that letter. So it took some time, it took some thought, it took some expression, and probably the kind of thing that it was hard for Jeremiah to find the words to put these things together, and even through inspiration as he put these things together, was an expression of what he felt and how he approached God during these times. It's called Lamentations to describe that shock and that misery. But the bottom line is, and one of the things that's most remarkable about this is, that it's God's silence in the middle of all this that resonates. They're struggling. They've been attacked. They've been abused. They've been ransacked. And yet God is silent. In the Hebrew Bible, it's not called Lamentations. It's actually called by this letter here, or this word, echa. And it's almost like the sound that's made when someone has that burst of emotion. You know what I'm talking about? When, like, maybe you've seen somebody, they're really sad about something, or they're really having a hard time, and you happen to walk up to them and you put your arms around them and you say, "Hey, it's okay, it's okay." And the moment you do, they feel that release and it just comes out, that emotion comes out. That's sort of a little bit of what we would understand about this. It's a cry of shock. It's the how. It's the word that comes to mind. And yet how is what we translate it as, but it really doesn't indicate the kind of blast of emotion and confusion that takes place in this. And it's called this because several of these chapters start with that expression coming out. It's kind of how. It's like, why did this happen? Where are you, God? Why have you left me? It's a lot of different questions that are encased in that one word. It's very different from anything that we have, but it's that kind of a shock and awe. In this first chapter that we're going to talk about, I'm just going to highlight a few things. Five times it says there's no one to comfort. Five times it uses the term groaning, meaning they don't even have the expressions. They just kind of are in misery, groaning. 17 times it's mentioned the word all, and every one of those times it's talking about the completeness or the totality of the suffering that they're going through. Again, as I read this and I talk about this, it's just a different kind of sermon, because I think about what we're talking about here is God is giving us permission. He is opening up our hearts to and helping show us that it's okay for us to have these moments where we despair and that we need to express those things to Him. And if David could do this and be acceptable to God, then certainly those of us who are going through tough, difficult times can approach Him with this sorrow in our hearts. Notice three times it says, cries out to God. And it uses Judah as kind of an abandoned and discarded widow. Someone who has nothing, absolutely nothing, and she is reaching out for His help. And there he sits in silence. So let's get into chapter 1, verse 1. Chapter 1, verse 1 says, "How lonely sits the city." That's that word, that just shock of how in the world could this have happened, that this city that was once so full of people now sits lonely. How like a widow she has become. She was great among the nations. She who was princess among the provinces has become a slave. I hope you're seeing what God is doing here through Jeremiah. And as he is weeping about this, he's trying to draw the distinction, that contrast that you see between those who are being blessed by God and are enjoying those blessings and those who have left that blessing, who have abandoned it, and it's no longer there with them. Verse 2 says, "She weeps bitterly in the night and with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her." Now, this is a unique and weird kind of way to say it. But in their time, they understood that there was a marriage, a covenant relationship between Judah and God. And he talked to them about not leaving them and not going out for other idols and pursuing other gods to worship them. Remember, in the Ten Commandments, he said, you know, "You should have no other God before me. You shouldn't make any graven images. You shouldn't do these things." Why? Because I'm a jealous God. So he tells us these things. And yet now what he's saying is, as I look at Judah, she's taken other lovers, so to speak. She's basically cheated on him. It's an adulterous thing in his eyes. But notice it also says her friends have dealt harshly with her. And when it talks about friends, what we need to understand is Judah at this time, in their fear of the coming Babylonians, they began to reach out to other nations for alliances. Rather than trusting in God and calling on Him for His protection and provision, instead they began to reach out to places like Egypt and Tyre and Sidon and the Moabites and Ammonites. And if you read in Jeremiah chapter 27, you're going to hear that some of these things are happening. But any kind of friend that can be bought is a friend that can be bought by somebody else. And ultimately, it seems that that's what Babylon did, that they reached out to them. And not only did those people who they were kind of gaining alliances with, those people were the ones who also turned on them and aided in their destruction, and even some of them laughed and mocked. The point of this is that despite Jeremiah giving 40 years of his life in talking to them about repenting and turning back to God and doing the right thing, After those 40 years, ultimately what Judah did is they still gave their heart to other idols. And they made friends with other nations. But those nations and those other gods were not capable of stopping the disciplined hand of God. And that's something for us to be reminded of even today. Verse 3 says, Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She now dwells among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. As you read this, I want you to understand that because they had been taken into exile, they had no home. There was no place for them to go. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the people that God had taken out of Egyptian bondage, hey, heard their cries and calls for rescue, sent Moses in, brought those people out. It's those very people who had been taken out of captivity and brought into the land that now were being taken out of the land and back into captivity. It's kind of a reversal of what God had done for them before. And this really shouldn't surprise them, because if you read Deuteronomy, when Moses is having the law read for a second time, and as he gets into Deuteronomy, the first half of that chapter is all about the blessings that you'll find if you trust in God. It's how he's going to multiply you, how he's going to give you provisions, and how he's going to take care of you and build your wealth and prosperity and create a sense of peace for you, that God will be with you to protect you. He'll go before you against your enemies and all of these things. It promises all of these things, but then you get down to the back part of the chapter, and it says, hey, but there are curses for those who choose to go in a different direction. And so, he says here in the last part of that chapter, though you become as numerous as the stars in the sky, few of you will be left because you would not listen to the Lord your God. Just as the Lord has found great pleasure in causing you to prosper and multiply, the Lord will find pleasure, capture this, in destroying you. That's hard for us to understand. Doesn't he love his people? Doesn't he want what's best for them? I think this is where this Lamentations is good for us to read and to study. Because here in our Western culture, as we see things today, we do everything in our power to avoid anything that's uncomfortable. We don't want to talk about hurting someone's feelings. We don't experience pain. We don't want to go through any kind of grief. We don't want to do any of those kinds of things. We actually do everything in our power to skirt around it, to step around, to kill it with what I would call toxic positivity. That may not sound right, but what I mean by that is just saying positive things and thinking that that's going to undo the hurt that you're feeling inside. No, it's reality. God implanted these emotions in us. He implanted the need for sorrow at times, and in this way, he is opening up our minds to, it's okay to sorrow. Not because of our sinfulness, but because sometimes there are things that are going to be difficult in this life. But also verse 4 says, the roads to Zion mourn, for none come to the festivals. It's almost like Jeremiah, as he's writing this, he's looking out on the city and he's thinking to himself, yeah, our homes are gone. And that's, you know, traumatic enough. Our city's gone. But now the temple, it's gone. It's scraped clean. It's everything that could be taken has been taken. And all that, but the priests are gone and the roads are torn up. People are not going to come for those festivals, those things where we look forward to having all of our family and everybody, all the promises that have been made to these people. All of us are gathering together to remind ourselves of the blessings of God. Those days are gone. They're never going to happen again. As he's looking out, he's writing this. This means the end of our religious practices. How are we going to worship with no priests? How are we going to worship and do the things we need to do with no temple? In their minds, understand how they see this and how they're lamenting. So in these first four verses, there are four things that jump out to me. The first one is Judah lost her status. She also lost her alliances. She lost her dwelling and she lost her rituals. The walls of security, however you want to view it, the things that they thought provided them the security that they had, those things had collapsed. What do you do in these moments? And the question comes, why does this happen? You know, I think about the words of Proverbs chapter 3, verse 11 and 12, where it talks about how no one should despise the discipline of the Lord. And you go to Hebrews chapter 12, and it says a little bit about this, that the discipline that we endure, you know, parent to child, but also from God's standpoint, is meant to bring about our holiness. So there's something to be said for that hard hand of God who brings us to discipline, who gives us what we need in those moments to wake us up and to bring us back. I remember when I was growing up and my father would discipline us. He'd spank us. He had some crazy ways of doing it. He'd walk down the hallway with a belt, you know, and snap that sucker and scare us to death. Never really struck us very hard, but enough to get our attention. My dad used to say, I believe in patting my kids on the back often enough, low enough, and hard enough. But then my dad would sit and hold me in his lap. And he'd tell me, you understand why this is happening, right? I want you to be a man of God. I want you to be the man you're supposed to be. And it's my job as your father to lead you this way and to take you down this path that'll help you be what God wants you to be. Hebrews 12 says that discipline is made for our holiness. It's meant to bring us back to holiness. And so while we may say, oh, that doesn't sound pleasant. No, it's not. In fact, Hebrews says it's not pleasant. But it brings us back to a discipline that gives us a sense of awareness of what's right and what's wrong. Why has this happened? Because the Lord has afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. You capture it? It's not anybody else. It's not Babylon. In fact, if you go on to read the rest of this chapter, you're going to see the Lord inflicted sorrow in his anger. He sent fire. He spread the net. He fastened the yoke around their necks. He caused their strength to fail. He rejected them. He assembled the enemy. Catch this. This was the third time Babylon had been in there. Maybe the first one was like, hey, guys, I got some folks over here ready to go. You know, the second time, guys, I'm serious about this. But it seems to me at this point, God's patience ran out and they needed to feel the consequence of their rebellion. And so he says here in verse 15, he trod us out like a wine press. I mean, do you have that vivid imagery in your mind? Stomping everything out of it? That's what is said about God. This did not come from Babylon. They could have easily blamed Babylon. No, Jeremiah is quick enough to say, hey, I've been warning us about this, and now it's happened. This is because the Lord is fed up with your rebellion. So let's talk about the things that we know they lost. They lost status. Notice how they felt about their city. It was a city full of people. Like, this is a great place. It's, you know, it's kind of like coming to Madison Church Christ. Oh, man, there's a lot of people here. That's wonderful. A princess among provinces. Oh, man, it's like, you know, the cream of the crop. It's the nicest of the cities. Zion and her majesty. Oh, it's like this is a royal city. And then precious treasures of old. Think back to all the treasures that they brought out of Egypt and how they brought them into the land and how they took their gold and they merged them together to make some of the emblems for the tabernacle and all the treasures that they had from way long ago. Those things have come along with them. This was a prized piece of property. You understand? And at the same time, heritage alone, their connection to that city, does not equate a healthy relationship with God. Just because you lived in that city, just because you had family who brought you there, just because you were the son or grandson or great-great-great-great-grandson of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, does not necessarily mean that you yourself are faithful. Do you think it's possible that some of us kind of ride the coattails of our heritage? Is it possible that maybe we think, oh, well, I come from a long line of faithful Christians, and that we rest on that? That was a danger for them, and it could be a danger for us as well. But then they also lost those alliances. We talked about they were told not to associate with some of these nations, and yet they brought them in for alliances. And the biggest problem was they began to trust those other nations for their protection and watch over them, as opposed to giving their fullness to God and trusting him to see things through. So notice they're betrayed, they're enslaved. There were none to help them. They were mocked. People rejoiced when they were taken. It says passersby looked on their misery and just looked at them and stared at them and mocked them as they came by and saw them. These people who were their friends were not their friends. And in the same way, if we go into idolatry, if we start taking and putting too much emphasis on one thing of our life and it takes over precedence in our relationship to God, then that can be an idol for us. But then also, if we create associations with people that are not wholesome for us, that take our allegiance away from God, and if we have to make a choice for choosing these friends over our relationship with God, you can see how we could be tempted in the same way to do that. But let me tell you, those things end up in the same way they did for them, betrayal, and they end up in emptiness. What about their dwelling? They lost their place. They didn't have any place to even pasture the flocks. All the flocks were taken. All the crops were taken. This place was completely ravaged. They were led away. They didn't have a home. They didn't have a place. They couldn't find a place to do, even put a tent up somewhere. And even if they were out there, they would have been taken captive as a result. So they had nothing. They lost all of those things. And it's funny to me that in this process, you may look at them and say, hey, they just kind of thought that if they had walls and had a structure around them, that in and of itself would create the security that they needed in their lives. That the structure itself would be what they would have. But thinking that those walls and structures are what will get us through is really kind of spiritually short-sighted, isn't it? Where does our rescue come from? Where does our support? Who is our stronghold? Who is our rock and our salvation? It's God. And yet they had found the substance of that place being their security. But then also they lost their rituals. And what do I mean by rituals? I don't mean any kind of pagan things. I just mean they would come to the temple. They would come and present their worship. They would come and do that however often they needed to do. And it's obvious as we look at this, when we know that because of their transgressions, God had brought this judgment upon them, that they had maybe honored those things a little bit too much. They got used to going to the place and doing their thing and then leaving, but then perhaps partaking in idolatrous behavior outside of that. You understand? So they were trying to live in both worlds a little bit. And so it became that the temple itself became the thing that they looked for, that they wanted to be a part of, that they would just go and check in at the temple, and if they would come and do their thing at the temple, then they would be just fine. And it's in Jeremiah chapter 7 that Jeremiah warned them, like way long before this, that, hey, you guys keep talking about going to the temple. Stop saying the temple is here, the temple is here, the temple is here. As if to say going to the church building and doing that with regularity, that equates a deeper connection and relationship to God. Is it possible that we have fallen into that temptation as well? Resting in our rituals creates a heartless, false sense of connection. Yeah, we have friends and connections here. We have relationships here. I'm not saying that we're not. But if all we come for is the social gathering and the relationships, but we don't come here to pour out our heart and lift it up to God, I think we're missing the point. What unites us together is Jesus Christ and the Father. So here Jeremiah ultimately speaks up on behalf of the people of Judah, and he says this: the Lord is in the right. And that's an awesome confession, right? For him to be able to say out loud, hey, this God is right in doing what he's done to us, for we have rebelled against his word. He says, look, O Lord, for I am in distress. My stomach churns. My heart is wrung within me because I have been very rebellious. In other words, the guilt of that, the consequence of that is right in front of me. But now I'm feeling the sorrow of what I did to bring this on. Verse 22 says, let all their evil doing come before you. He's saying, hey, you see what these bad people have done to us. You see what the Babylonians have done. Take note of that and deal with them as you have dealt with us. He's saying, hey, we have felt the fury. Please turn your heart and your mind on them once again, because our groans are many and our heart is faint. We don't have much left to give. But as they're calling out to God, and as Jeremiah is writing this lament and he's expressing this to God, there's nothing. There's nothing in return. And it has me wondering, if the whole point of this is for us to sit and to realize where we are. Because the questions that we may be asking, where are you, God? Why have you done this? Why have you abandoned me? All of those things, we may be saying those over and over. And it may just be that God is saying, hey, hear what you're asking. What if what we're asking, where are you, God? Why have you done this? Where have you gone? If we ourselves could ask that same question, that maybe God is looking back at us and saying, where are you? Where have you gone? Why have you done this? Sometimes that silence causes us to be a little bit more reflective. We talked about how it's a place for protest and confusion, a way to process emotion, an opportunity to articulate pain in hoping to find that rescue. But it's also a time to just stop and reflect and do some self-evaluation and deep contemplation. Has my sin caused some of the struggles in my life? So, final question for us to consider is, where do you place your security? If you place your security just in this building, in this place, well, that's, you know, eventually this building will come to ruin. If you put your trust and your confidence in the things that you have and the structure that you have around you that you think gives you security and investment and those kinds of things, if you put all of your trust in that, then you're falling into the same temptation that they might have had. If you think it's about the rituals that we do, if we just come to church and be here for our attendance and all those kinds, again, I'm saying as I look at this and I'm trying to find an application for us today, as I look at their sorrow and their grief and their burden, I think what God is saying is I want you to feel the sorrow for the things that you're doing as well. And it's not meant to, you know, put everybody down and set you all straight. It's just meant to say God is giving us this avenue to approach him with our sorrow, to ask questions of him, and to wait as he patiently answers us. And even if he doesn't answer, maybe just ask those questions again and again to find out if those questions actually are the questions that you need to answer as well. This morning, there may be some in this room, and I'd venture to say there is, or there are people in this room who are in sorrow and grief and struggle and dismay and confusion and hurt and anger and all of those things. And you've found the avenue by which you can lift those things up to God. Well, what I want to say to all of us is God is inviting our hearts to his. He's asking all of us to reveal those things and to share those woes with him and come with a sincerity of repentance and change. And when we do that, those laments can be turned into restoration. And that's available to anyone this morning. And if any of you have a need, please come while we stand and sing.